kind of influx that hasn't stopped.
Kaba says they're looking at other options for housing the Ivory Coast refugees.
We are seeing with local authorities if there are new villages where they can be accommodated, or if we need to set up a camp in order to reach people better and provide more assistance.
Ofer Biakwa-Stockton, NPR News, Dakar.
A donor in what's widely recognized as the world's first successful organ transplant has died. Ronald Lee Herrick passed away Monday in Maine at the age of 79. On December 23, 1954, Herrick donated a kidney to his twin brother, allowing his sibling to live for 8 more years. The lead surgeon, Dr. Joseph Murray, went on to win the Nobel Prize. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse.
Programs on WILL are made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Something familiar, something peculiar.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our look back at some of the most entertaining interviews of the year with Stephen Sondheim. Also, one of our most popular interviews of the year, Matt Richtel, talks about how our digital devices are entertaining and informing us, but also distracting us and driving us crazy. Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is our producer. The following program comes from the Focus Archive, so that means that for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls. Of all American men of letters, the person who is most closely associated in people's minds with the Mississippi River is Mark Twain. Sort of a lot of the ideas that we have about the river and images that we have about life on the river in the years before the Civil War come from Twain. But the fact is that when Mark Twain sat down to write some of his best-known works, he hadn't been on the river in decades, and the life that he was writing about at that point was just a memory. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we will look back to the earlier, wilder days of the big river, and our guest is Lee Sandlin. He's a journalist. He lives in Chicago. He's been a regular contributor to the Chicago Reader, and he is the author of a book, it is his first, that's titled Wicked River, the Mississippi, When It Last Ran Wild. It's published by Pantheon. And he says that while a lot of the people who lived on and along the river needed it, they did not love it. In fact, they thought the Mississippi was a very dangerous and very squalid place. And he tells a lot of very interesting stories in the book. And Mr. Sandlin, hello. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
We appreciate it. I think that, you know, it's hard, probably even for people who know what the river is like now, to imagine this earlier version, the wilder state. As you write about it here in the book, you write that now the Mississippi is, for all intents and purposes, a man-made artifact.
Yeah.
You also write it can barely be called a river at all in any traditional sense.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it. This is not a new phenomenon, actually. This isn't something that happened with recent industrialism. This is something that actually started around 1880, where the Army Corps of Engineers was given this brief by Congress to reduce flooding on the river. And in effect, the only practical way of doing it was to destroy the river and rebuild it as an artificial creation. So that's a process that's been going on for about 130 years now.
So really what we have is not so much, as you say, a natural thing anymore. We have something that's been an engineered kind of ship channel. But
exactly.
Compared to what it was, mm-hmm. it is not what it was.
It's not anything like what it was. And that was one of the fascinating things to me, was to try to go back to this era and just try to imagine what it was like living along the Mississippi in those days, because we really don't have any idea how difficult and dangerous the river was. We take it as essentially tamed now.
Yeah, and I think as well, I said, and you certainly noted in the book, that a lot of the ideas is the images we have about the river come from Twain.
Yeah.
In fact, before Twain, a lot of people wrote about life along the river, and that, well, maybe these things are not in print anymore. They still do exist, and there are many, many journals and accounts from people about their experiences on the Mississippi from that time.
Oh, there are hundreds of books that were written about the Mississippi before the Civil War. But when you say they're not in print now, not only are they not in print now, they weren't even in print in Mark Twain's time. Mm. He complains in Life on the Mississippi that he found it very difficult to find any of the older books on the river. So they had disappeared really well over a century ago. And the only way that I was able to get to them, this book would have been impossible to do 15 or 20 years ago, because I would have had to spend my life going around to obscure regional libraries looking through antiquarian sections. But what's happened in the last several years is that Google Books has been traveling to these libraries and doing this whole-scale scanning into their archives of essentially every book on the shelves in a lot of libraries. Mm-hmm. So I was able to find accounts of the Mississippi that not only hadn't been reprinted in 150 years, I don't think they've been read in 150 years.
Yeah. Well, yeah. What was your interest here? What got you started on this project?
Well, you mentioned in the introduction that I was writing for the Chicago Reader, and I had done over several years a series of stories about my family history. Mm-hmm. And my family is from downstate Illinois. They grew up in Edwardsville across from St. Louis. And when I was researching the story, I was spending a lot of time in Edwardsville and going back and forth across the Mississippi, and that really kind of sparked the interest that I had. But my assumption was there really wasn't any point in trying to write about it because there was Twain, just sort of like Mount Everest over the whole subject. And then when I realized that his Mississippi was really kind of a nostalgic invention in many ways, that he was remembering the river as it had been in his childhood and not describing it the way that it was in the time when he was writing, I started wondering whether it might be possible to find more direct accounts of what it had been like back then, and to see if I could reconstruct what the river was like then.
Yeah, you sort of point out, and I think that it's true, is that there, as far as people are concerned, Twain owns the Mississippi,
oh, yeah,
like Dickens owns Victorian London. You know,
exactly.
As if there was no point in coming along and trying to say something about it because, well, what all that could be said had been said.
Yeah, even now. I mean, you know, here I am writing. I mean, Twain wrote Huckleberry Finn in the 1880s, and when I would mention to people I was writing about the Mississippi, they would all say, well, why bother? It's been done. It's completely covered in Mark Twain. And so that's the extent to which people still think of him as the only authority on the river.
Yeah.
And I should stress, by the way, that the book isn't like a takedown of Twain, because ultimately I ended up with a tremendous amount of respect for his vision of the river. In some ways, I liked him better at the end of the project than I did at the beginning, in part because he was so much better writer than all the other writers on the Mississippi. There's a reason why his book survived and the others were forgotten.
Well, do you think, are there some important, and this is not to knock Twain at all, are there some, though, important sorts of ideas about the river and about life on the river that we have received from Twain that aren't really quite right?
Yeah, I would say that the biggest one, well, the first thing you have to remember about Twain is that he was writing, you know, Huck Finn was originally intended as a children's book, so he was not setting out to do documentary realism. So even though he included a surprising amount of the kind of the darker material about the river, he was still softening it quite a lot for his audience. And the people who were writing in the 1830s and 1840s about the river weren't softening at all, and they presented the river as a very dangerous, very crowded, filthy, and casually violent place in a way that is much more darker, really, than what Twain did.
Yeah. Well, that's you made this point and I mentioned it, that while people who lived on and along the river, they depended on it. They knew it was very important them, but they didn't love it.
No, they really didn't. Twain is, in fact, the first writer that I could find who wrote about the river with real affection. Mm-hmm. You would get a sort of sneaking affection sometimes in the background in a few of these earlier writers, but for the most part, their constant stress was how dangerous it was, what a hard life it was, and how wild and uncivilized a place it was.
Yeah, not only natural danger, we can talk about,
too.
But also people, too, that it was a place where there was a lot of crime.
Yes.
There was a lot of casual violence. There was enormous prostitution. There was just about every form of bad behavior that you can possibly think running up and down this water highway every day.
Exactly. I mean, it was in a lot of ways a completely lawless state. And one of the things that was sort of fascinating to me, and maybe one of the truths of human nature, that you were still able to find people who were in the midst of this constructing very ordinary, dull lives for themselves and walling off all this chaos that was all around them. And it was a very, very violent, casually violent place. The threshold, the flashpoint for violence was a lot lower than it is even now, where we think of ourselves as living in a very violent society. Mm.
And that, there are a lot of great stories here about wonderfully outsized characters, stories that no doubt grew in the telling. But you have to wonder, was there something about the environment itself that made it such a wild place, or was that it had something to do with the kind of people? This was the frontier, after all. Was it have something to do with the kind of people that were attracted to it?
Well, I think that was a large factor. I mean, it's hard to imagine now how little organized society there really was on the river. I mean, society was really kind of an improvisation. There was very little direct communication from place to place. It was very hard to get from one place to another except by means of the river. And so that meant that much of the organizational structure of a civilization that we take for granted just wasn't there. And they had to make their own rules and their own laws. But the other thing, too, as you say, there were a lot of people who were attracted to that. And so a lot of people were coming out there, I think, just because they enjoyed the absence of any restraints on their behavior.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Lee Sandlin. He's the author of the book Wicked River, the Mississippi When It Last Ran Wild. That's published by Pantheon. And questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We talked a little earlier about how really even in back as far as the 1880s, I guess, that the Corps, under the direction of the federal government, started to make the river what it was going to become. This artificially constructed ship channel. What they did is they dredged it and they smoothed it out. They took a lot of the kinks out of it. So you really can't. It's hard to imagine the river in its natural state, which posed all kinds of dangers to navigation. There were a lot of problems that you could run into, and very little, if anything, was actually marked.
Yeah, there were no markers of any kind on the river then, before the Civil War. That was all things that happened later. There actually were hydrological engineers and river navigators in those days who said that the Mississippi was essentially impassable. And it's a tribute to ingenuity, the human ingenuity, that so many people still contrived ways of getting down it. But if you try to imagine what the river would be like now without all of those controls, it would silt up almost immediately because the Army Corps keeps the river dredged. And even though the river is 150 to 200 feet deep in places, in those days immense sandbars built up that blocked almost all ships from traveling down stretches of the river. I found an account written by a military expedition in the late 18th century, and they were trying to get from the future site of Minneapolis down to St. Louis, and they got as far as southern Wisconsin. They picked the wrong time to do it. They traveled in the summer when the river was low, but they recorded that their boats, in the time it took them to get from Minnesota to Wisconsin, went aground on sandbars 200 times.
Wow.
So you have a sense from there just how difficult it was to navigate the river.
And the river was constantly changing.
Yeah. It was endlessly changing. It was changing every day, which is one of the reasons there were never any good maps of it in those days. And if the Army Corps hadn't intervened, the shape of the river now would be dramatically different from what it is today.
And as a result of flooding, storms, sorts of things?
There's a natural process called river meandering, which happens on almost every river. But the Mississippi, because it's so large, the changes are much more dramatic. And so the course of the river was shifting daily, and but because there weren't that many natural obstacles like mountains and deep ravines that would hold the river in place, it was going over essentially flat land, it would meander very dramatically. And this was just what rivers, this is a natural phenomenon that rivers do, but with the Mississippi, because the volume of the current was so strong, and there was, and the land was so flat, the changes could be catastrophic pretty casually.
We have a couple of callers here. Why don't we talk with them? First, someone in Lovington. This is line one we'll start with. Hello.
Hi. Yeah. I've been along the Mississippi, I don't know it, but, you know, between Hannibal and Alton, St. Louis, and spent some time over there around Golden, I think, last year for a day, and driving around and going down the river, and you can really see going along the road how, what you're talking about, how that, you know, there's just islands out there, you know, all over the place. I guess maybe I wasn't even along the main channel. I don't know. I'm driving along the east side. It's pretty wide.
Yeah.
I guess my question was, right now, to, you know, maybe there's ports you don't see that are, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, but right now Hannibal doesn't look like much of anything. I think a grain loading facility along the side between Quincy, and they got just stuff everywhere.
Sure,
Was Hannibal, where exactly was Twain? Surely he traveled up and down, had a range up and down that river other than Hannibal.
Oh, yeah, he worked as a steamboat pilot for years before the Civil War, so he saw pretty much the length of the river, because a lot of the steamboats ran from the upper valley all the way down to New Orleans and back, and he made that trip several times. So he knew the river really well as it was in, say, the late 1850s, just before the Civil War.
I don't know, about middle 80s, I swam in the Mississippi River, and you need a shower after that.
That was true even then. The river was always famous for being pretty foul, but people were drinking from it until the early 20th century. And I don't know what it was doing to them, but they were just taking their drinking for water from it, not filtering it.
I also helped clean up some after the big flood down there at Hall. It's kind of across from Hannibal.
Yeah.
And, man, the smell is just...
Yeah, it's pretty startling, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We'll have another caller here. Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hi, I have a question. Did you consult Native American folklore? The Natchez Indians, you know, lived along the Mississippi, and I'm wondering if your study includes their discussion or folk beliefs about the river.
Well, I didn't do that as much as I wanted to, although it did do some. One of the great... stories that I turned up was from the Native Americans of the Lower Valley, whose image of the river was that it was a sleeping dragon that would wake up every 7 years and kill everybody who'd settled along.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
All right, thanks. We've talked about the fact that the river itself was very dangerous, that it was ever-changing.
Yeah.
It seems like there are also some really remarkable stories about the forces of nature.
Sure.
Things like, you know, big storms, like tornadoes, and of course, you know, now and again here at our part of the country, we do talk about the big earthquakes.
The big earthquake,
1811, 1812 along the New Madrid Fault, and people wonder about, you know, whether that something like that could happen again. You have some accounts of, in fact, what happened to New Madrid in that quake.
Yes. Yeah, it was quite an extraordinary event, and it's the largest earthquake ever recorded in the continental United States. And I still haven't actually been able to find a lot of agreement among geologists as to what caused it specifically, because it's not near any of the tectonic plate borders. So why that would be the source of such a huge quake is, I'm not a geologist, so they may have settled this and not told me, but the impression I get is that there's still some doubt as to why it was that force, that catastrophic a quake. And, of course, if the cause is unknown, there's no way of saying that it won't happen again. But it was the last of the three big quakes actually rang church bells in Montreal. So you get a sense of how much of the continent was affected by this quake.
Yeah, it's very, I'm sure it's very frustrating for people when they hear that geologists make this prediction. They say, well, we can tell you that there's a 90% chance of a major quake on the Niemadra Fault sometime in the next 50 years.
Yeah, exactly. Very
so, helpful. So what is it? Yeah. People say, well, what exactly am I supposed to do with that? Although the thing is that I'm sure that they would say, well, that means that what you should do is start thinking now about what would happen. You know, what you would do.
Sure.
I think that there's real concern that there hasn't been the kind of preparation for this event that.
Yeah, you don't really find people talking about buildings being, you know, sort of built earthquake secure the way that earthquake resistant, the way that they do require buildings that are along, you know, the tectonic plates on the coasts. But, you know, it is a very open question. How bad would a new earthquake be? Because there are quakes around the Midwest. You know, there's very small ones. So it's not a geologically dead region. What would happen, though, if anything, the scale of New Madrid were to happen now, it's kind of a frightening prospect. Because at the time of the New Madrid quake, the land around the epicenter of the fault was pretty much empty. So, you know, there were very few people were actually, there were only a few casualties among the people on land then. It was different on the river itself because hundreds of boats were swamped and people drowned. But there was very little settlement there. So it kind of passed in some way, I don't want to say unnoticed, but it didn't seem like this enormous catastrophe that affected an entire population the way it would now.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk with someone else in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I'm Mr. Shandlin.
Yes.
Does your book discuss all the fur trade that had to be going on through there? I just finished a book called Fur Fortune and Empire, and, of course, the Mississippi played a big part in that.
Yeah. I didn't focus that much on the fur trade specifically because there are a number of terrific books about it. Beginning with one by Bernard DeVota called Across the Wide Missouri, which is a beautiful account of the fur trade. So I felt that, you know, I was trying to focus on areas that people may not be as familiar with. But, of course, the fur trade was enormously influential in the exploration and development of the whole area.
Thank you.
Sure.
Well, certainly the point stands that this river, the Mississippi, and the major rivers that fed into it were carried enormous amounts of all kinds of things, enormous amounts of freight, and also enormous amounts of people.
Yeah. People were constantly coming down the river. And of course, not always voluntarily, because the slave trade was, you know, the river was a major channel for the North American slave trade, mm-hmm. especially after the international slave trade had been banned. What was starting to happen instead is slaves were being moved from state to state and being brought directly from Africa.
Well, once those people who were traveling voluntarily, once they got to the end, how did they get back? Or did they go back?
That's an interesting question because before steamboats came in, it was almost impossible. You can imagine these very large boats trying to move against the current was not on any level an easy task. And they tried every known method and invented many of their own for trying to move these boats against this immense downriver current. And often what would happen is they would just give up. They would sell the boat for scrap. And the only way that they could get back home literally was to walk back home. So they would travel thousands of miles down the river by boat and then travel thousands of miles upriver on foot.
That's really what I suppose made the steamboats so important.
Oh, yeah.
And that is that they could go against the current so that they could go, not only could they go down, they could go up.
Yeah, exactly. And they really, you know, dramatically changed the nature of the river culture when they hit their height, which was around in the 1850s. You know, I found myself surprised. I don't know why I was surprised by this when I first came across the numbers, but maybe I only pictured there was, you know, 10 grand steamboats or something traveling the river. But about the time of the Civil War, there were several thousand steamboats on the river at any given moment.
Yeah. That's one of those things that, you know, if there's anything that is a characteristic image of life on the river, it's that.
It's the
classic steamboat.
Yeah. But the fascinating thing is that the steamboat had a very brief period of dominance of the river. It really was from about 1830 or 1840, and by 1880, when Twain went back to the Mississippi, the steamboat era was over. There were only a few boats left on the river by then.
Yeah. Well,
so it was dominated, but for a very short period.
And one of the things I was really struck by in reading about some of the things that you write about the steamboat is that for those people who could actually afford to have a cabin,
it was
tremendously expensive.
It was. Yeah, it would cost $100 to travel up from New Orleans to the Upper Valley, and for comparison, $100 for one of the steamboat employees would be several months' salary. So you get a sense of just the kind of disparity in wealth that was already existing then.
I couldn't quite imagine who would actually want to make that trip who also could afford to spend that kind of money.
Yeah, well, it was a very glamorous way of traveling. They did treat people like kings on these boats. I mean, the boats were incredibly beautiful. The interior cabins were gorgeous. They laid on spectacular meals. It was like the ultimate cruise ship in those days. And it was also part of there was a huge tourist industry developed along the Mississippi in those days. A lot of European travelers came to America with the assumption, just as people now would say, we want to go to the Grand Canyon, was got to go up the Mississippi. It's the essential American experience.
And although some of the things that they wrote about, the way that Americans behaved.
Americans were not known for their table manners in those days. And they would lay out these spectacular buffets. And the Europeans were always, they may have been exaggerating for effect, but they would describe how the Americans would descend on these spectacular buffets like locust swarms and just gobble them all down without saying a word to each other and then bolt and go off for a drink. And the Europeans were used to a much more leisurely notion of how to have a meal.
Yeah, it was somebody wrote also about all the spitting and about how the women just despaired of keeping the bottoms of their dresses clean because of all the spitting.
Yeah, that was a writer named Frances Trollope. Her son Anthony Trollope is a much better known writer now, but at the time she was famous. And yeah, the spitting really got on her nerves in a very fundamental way.
The other thing, I suppose, another thing one would say about these boats is that a major way of passing the time on these boats was gambling.
Yeah, it was in some ways the only way. I mean, if they weren't gambling, they were trying to hustle each other in other ways. But gambling was a huge preoccupation. And their great legacy, you can make a case that the river's lasting contribution to Western culture was that poker was invented on the Mississippi.
And that, and maybe also that we now have floating casinos.
Yeah, that's a lot of it too. Yeah. There were gambling boats apart from the steamboats, and brothel boats as well that were traveling up and down the river.
Our guest in this hour, Focus, Lee Sandlin, lives in Chicago. He's a journalist. He's been a regular contributor to the Chicago Reader, and he is the author of a book. This is his first book that's just recently been published. It's titled Wicked River, The Mississippi When It Last Ran Wild. It's published by Pantheon, and it's his attempt to get back to tell some stories about the river in its earlier days, in its pre-war days, when it truly was a very wild and lawless and uncivilized and dangerous and dirty place. At least that's what the people of the time seem to feel. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. There was a lot of crime around and on the river.
Yeah.
There were river pirates. There were also pirates on land. Maybe you tell a story about the Crow's Nest.
The Crow's Nest was, in the early part of the 19th century, the most notorious of the pirate camps that was on the lower Mississippi. It was one of the islets that are on the river. It's gone now. It became this sort of center of organized lawlessness where the pirates were known, even in that time, for being unusually savage. And they were, in fact, destroyed. The island was destroyed during the New Madrid earthquake. And it appears that that's where the pirates all disappeared, was in the wake of that earthquake. So They came to a pretty spectacular end.
Now, what about there also is a story about how people, it was this center of crime and they preyed on people around, and that so that eventually the people who lived around there finally, that's the story, is that they finally had it.
Yeah, well, the stress is that the story is, I've never been able to figure out whether the story actually happened or not, but they all said that what happened was that when they finally had enough, there was a whole flotilla of boats that it was that had been sort of stalled by the weather, and they were above the crow's nest, and they decided we're going to take care of it. So they invaded the crow's nest, and they killed everybody that they found there, and that for a while afterwards the river was peaceful. And I don't know, because, you know, the people tend to puff up these stories in retrospect, and I've never really been able to figure out whether that happened, because the direct consequence of that is that there seems to have been a lull in the activity of the crow's nest, but then several months later it picked up again and everything was back to the way it was. So they may have been coming up with a story just to sort of cheer each other up to say, no, it was possible to do something.
Yeah, and you but, sort of theorized that no doubt long time after that, that there were people who said, well, you know.
Oh, I was there, yeah.
Exactly. I was there.
Every old guy in the river would be saying, I was there when we took the crow's nest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. Let's talk with someone else here again in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. My question has two parts. The first part is, do you know anything about people that lived along the river with big families selling their extra kids or their kids that they couldn't support? The second part is, do you know if that happened, when it ended? Thank you.
I heard or read stories about that. Whether that was true or not, well, you know, part of the difficulty with that is that a lot of the labor relationships, especially involving children, look identical to slavery even when then nobody used that word, you know, so that kids would be apprenticed to somebody on the river. But the apprenticeship really amounted to slavery. There was a tremendous amount of that. Whether it was organized quite in that way that they ended up being sold through the slave markets, you know, there were, you know, the vast majority of the slaves were black Africans or their descendants. There were white people who were sold in the slave markets as well. Often they were trying to work out debts. And so there was a certain number of you know, the story you're talking about isn't impossible, but I wasn't able to find any reliable numbers about it.
It was dangerous to try to travel on the river at night, so essentially people didn't do it.
Yeah.
But what happened, though, when it would get dark, boats, at certain places, big numbers of boats would all tie up together.
Yes.
And what you would get, in effect, would be a temporary, for that night, you would get this floating city.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that there were places where, you know, pretty much anything went.
Oh, sure. Well, the dockside towns, the harbors and the wharves, were known as the most dangerous and sordid and sort of corrupt places along the river, and they were basically servicing the boat trade. And in a lot of towns, especially in the spring and fall, there would be hundreds of boats tied up before a lot of towns every single night, and they'd be different boats every night. So you get a sense of just this immense volume of traffic that was coming down the river. And these towns along, you know, Vicksburg had a sort of a second town that was the riverfront town. It was called Vicksburg Landing. And Natchez had one. The main town was on a bluff above the river. It was called Natchez on the Hill, and there was this disorderly second town along the river, and it was known as Natchez Under the Hill, and they're supposed to have the most ornate brothels outside of St. Louis or New Orleans.
The townspeople must have had real mixed feelings about this. On the one hand, it meant trade and that meant money, but on the other hand, I'm sure that they thought these people were just nothing but trouble.
Yeah, they did. Well, and not just the townspeople. All the lands people who lived along the river hated the river people, in part because, you know, if you think about it, it was very, very easy for the river people to steal things because you got whatever you wanted onto your boat, and the boat took off at the speed of the current, and there weren't any other boats that moved faster than the current. So once you were back on the river, you were gone. If somebody, you know, and before telegraphs came in, you know, a farmer who saw his most valuable property stolen couldn't do anything about it. There was nobody to call. He had no way of calling anyone, any authorities downriver, and there often weren't any authorities. So often what would happen is that if they saw the river people just docking their boat overnight, they would just open fire, just assume these people would go. And that's one of the reasons the boat cities started happening, is that the townspeople at least were willing to tolerate the presence of the boat people. And because they would come into town and they'd go to the brothels and the casinos and they'd spend money. But for anywhere else on the river, it was considered usually really risky for a boat person to just walk on shore.
Well, I'm sure it was also the case that as you were going down the river, there would have been places where there were few people living, or maybe nobody. So that also meant that if you were on the river and you got into trouble,
you were on your own. Yeah, exactly so. And a lot of people came to grief that way. If they were traveling the river at the wrong time of year when the river wasn't really passable, or got into some sort of trouble with the boat, there was no help for you. You know, you might possibly be able to get, signal one other boat and somebody might be willing to help you, but they'd most likely be actually just set out to cheat you first off, gouge you for whatever they could get for their supplies. Mm.
Was there attempts to have some kind of law, enforcement, either next to the river
amateur,
or on it?
The townspeople formed these things called vigilance committees and committees of public safety. And they were essentially the first versions of lynching parties. And they would arrest people on whatever reason, and they would try them, and they would usually do the punishments themselves. We think now of lynching as being a death sentence, but that was actually became the dominant meaning more after the Civil War. Before then, a lynching meant anything that happened to you as a result of one of these lynching parties, and it could be death, but it could also be a beating, it could be branding, it could be run out of town on a rail. You could call any of those, you'd say you'd been lynched.
So maybe people have heard this expression, being tarred, feathered, and run out of town on a rail.
Yeah.
That wasn't something somebody just made up. People
actually did do it. And being run out of town on a rail, I don't want to get too graphic for your listeners here, but the rail was a split rail with a sharp edge, and people were forced to sit on it naked. And so being run out of town on the rail was not just like some sort of public humiliation. You could end up permanently scarred by having that done to you.
We have about 15 minutes left, maybe a little bit less, in this hour of Focus, talking with Lee Sandlin about his book, Wicked River, the Mississippi When It Last Ran Wild. It's published by Pantheon, and it's about life on the Mississippi River in the years before the Civil War, when it truly was a very wild place. And you can read it, and questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about the steamboat.
Yes.
And about how the steamboat really changed the river life. Because it could go against the current. So before, people just took advantage of the fact that the current went, so you put a boat in there and you floated it, and it went.
Yeah.
And you could go all the way down. Well, when the steamboat came along, people could actually go upriver as well. So there's all sorts of stories, I'm sure, associated with the boats and with life. We also talked about famous disasters. Probably the most famous, was the worst maritime disaster in U.S. history concerned a riverboat. Tell us the story of what happened to the Sultana.
The Sultana was a riverboat that was, it was built during the Civil War, and it began traveling the river after the Union recaptured the Mississippi from the south, and which happened in 1863. And it was this enormous steamboat, one of the greatest and most lavish ones on the river. And it got sort of requisitioned for military service at the end of the Civil War to transport repatriated Yankee prisoners of war, ones who had been kept at Cahaba and at Andersonville. And these soldiers were in really poor shape. It wasn't, the South was in horrible financial shape by the end of the war, and they were barely able to keep their own soldiers alive. And, of course, the prisoners had suffered the most. And so there felt to be this urgent need to get them out of the South as fast as possible, especially in the wake of Lincoln's assassination, because they thought that the Civil War might break out all over again just because of that. So they took this steamboat and they loaded it with as many prisoners as they could get on board. And this was a boat that was designed to carry about 400 people. And by the time it set off for the north, there were more than 2,000 people on board. And it did not make it all the way north. The boiler blew up when it was just north of Memphis. And no one knows the exact death totals, but it was pretty clearly above 1,500, perhaps as many as 2,000 people died. And it was, in fact, more people died on that boat than died on the Titanic. But, you know, it happened about a week after Lincoln's assassination, and no one really paid that much attention to it. So it became this sort of, not only was it the worst disaster in American history, it was one of the least known, was a very surreal and strange experience for the people on board. So one of the things that I did in my book was try to recreate as closely as possible what the experience had been like for the people traveling.
Yeah. It looks, there's a photograph here of the Sultana.
Yeah, it's an amazing photo.
And it's an amazing photo because it looks like on every available surface on the boat, there were people standing, and it looks like they're so packed in together. They couldn't have sat down, and there were stories about how there we had so many people on the boat that the crew on the boat were saying, "Could you please just don't move?
Don't move,
because they were afraid that the boat actually would tip over."
The most telling story that I found about that is that when the captain of the boat was known as one of the best steamboat captains on the river. And when he saw what they were doing to his boat, how many prisoners that were getting aboard before it left Vicksburg on its last voyage, he got drunk before they left port, and he stayed drunk all the way up until the end. Mm. So they had a pretty good idea this was not a good practice that they were doing.
Boiler explosions apparently were fairly common.
Yeah, they were. You know, these boilers were actually extraordinarily well made. They weren't sloppy pieces of construction, but the thing is, they were designed to run on pure water. And they weren't designed to run on Mississippi River mud, and nobody bothered to filter the water before they'd put them into the boilers. So that there was essentially this slosh of mud in these boilers all the time, and they would cause the boilers to heat unevenly and just blow up unpredictably. And they just thought, well, it costs too much to filter the water, so we're not going to do it. Which is what happened to a lot of stories about the Mississippi. It's not necessarily unknown to us today, that similar kind of thinking, but they were not very concerned with the safety of the people they were carrying.
All right, let's talk with someone in Champaign County. This is Line 1. Hello.
Hi, I don't know if this would be a period that you were chronicling, but maybe you know about it anyway, and I can't remember where I recall hearing this story, but I know it was word of mouth.
Okay.
And this was the idea that there was the barge trade, and so this was after the steamboat era.
Yeah.
Slaves and others, I guess there was a culture of slavery up and down the river, too.
Yes.
Coal mining, I had just learned recently on the show, it was an exception in Illinois. It wasn't a slave state if you were in the coal mine. So, yeah. So there's a whole culture that goes up and down the river. But people who were working on these, either whether they were indentured to the corporation or slaves or something, would steal wrought iron off of the windows in St. Louis area and hang them off the side of the boat. And then when they got in, they were given a little bit of R&R in New Orleans. And they would go back at night and collect this.
Really? I hadn't heard that.
A lot of the wrought iron that you see in New Orleans is
salvaged.
Could have been purloined from St. Louis area.
That's not surprising at all to me. I don't think I'd heard that story specifically, but you know there was such an enormous trade in everything stolen. That it's really not of any surprise at all. It's fascinating. I wish I'd known that when I put it in the book.
Yeah, I don't know actually what era that would have been, but I suppose it could have been all along. I mean, St. Louis was a fairly early.
Yeah, St. Louis and New Orleans were built at about the same time. The original city core, the old St. Louis looked a lot like the French Quarter in New Orleans.
Yeah, I'm from the area too, and my maternal grandfather used to swim across the river at an early.
In
the 30s, I guess it would have been. But I don't know if he would consider trying it now if he was the same age.
Yeah,
but.
I don't know. It would be pretty risky now, I think.
All right.
Pretty
thanks, Scott.
Yeah, thank you. Let's go on to another caller. This is Urbana, line two. Hello.
Really a fascinating discussion. Really appreciate it. I was listening to the program, and I didn't hear everything, but I was on a recent trip to Vicksburg to the National Battlefield.
Yes.
I had a chance to go on the Cairo, which is this old steamship that was buried in mud and then rediscovered in some period and then kind of reconstructed there on the site. And, I just found that whole visit very fascinating, you know, and highly recommended if people are kind of looking for a, kind of walk into the inside of this, what is really this kind of the skeletal remains of this steamship. I'm just wondering if your guests would maybe have any experience with that or could talk about it a little bit.
You know, the river was littered with wrecked steamboats, and it is fascinating that some of them are still there. The Sultana, for instance, is now, little pieces have been found, but most of it is still buried under soybean fields in Arkansas because the river changed course. But there was a huge trade in salvage of wrecked steamboats. So you can find pieces of them, and occasionally people have turned up entire steamboats that no one did salvage that have been, you know, under the river for 150 years.
Mm-hmm. Have you been to Vicksburg and been on the Cairo?
I haven't been on the Cairo. I've been to Vicksburg. Yeah.
As a somebody with interest in river history, I'd highly recommend that. It is kind of a surreal experience. You have this. Well, like I said, it's kind of as much as could be salvaged of the vessel, and then they've reconstructed essentially the skeletal outline of the structure of the steamboat. It's very
they're
kind of like stepping back in time.
Yeah, they're fascinating things. A lot of the relics that have survived, and there are.
I appreciate your really appreciate your comments.
We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Lee Sandlin. His book is Wicked River, the Mississippi When It Last Ran Wild, published by Pantheon. Questions are welcome. If somebody wants to call real quick, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The book is full of fascinating characters. As I said before, something about this place at this time tended to draw some pretty outsized characters.
Yeah.
Is there any individual that just sort of stands out in your mind as just being one of the most fascinating people, the kind of person that you say, well, if I really could go back and meet somebody, this is the person I would actually want to
meet?
There's
a writer named Timothy Flint who wrote before Twain was considered the great authority on the Mississippi, and I gave a chapter of the book over to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was fascinating to me because he seemed to embody all of these different contradictions that we were talking about. He actually was kind of the best writer of this earlier crop before Twain. And although I don't know that he's really he's ripe for a revival or anything, but he wasn't a bad writer. And he was just this fascinating character because he hated the Mississippi, but he was continually drawn back to it. And he had this intense Puritan streak where he was spending his time, he was a minister for a lot of his life, furiously denouncing people for sins that would strike us basically as fairly trivial now. Smiling on the Sabbath drove him into a rage. And yet at the same time, he really ended up liking the people that he was meeting all along the way. And I found that really, kind of heartening in a way, that somebody who was so stiff-necked and so kind of obnoxious and who so openly hated the life on the river would still find himself kind of opening up more because of this experience of being there. And he would have been kind of an interesting guy to talk to.
Yeah. And this was, he eventually, was this the guy that eventually settled in Cincinnati became became a writer professionally, was very successful. And I think that it was, was Miss Trollope. Didn't she write about having
Miss Trollope stayed with him briefly when she passed through Cincinnati and said that he was the most interesting man that she'd met in the American interior. And she saw all these sort of different contradictions in him and was really kind of fascinated by him. And characteristically, he liked her a lot until he read what she wrote about the Mississippi. And he, even though he hated the Mississippi, he hated even more other people saying they hated the Mississippi. So he became just this bitter critic of her book, even though if he'd read it, I think Cole, he would have agreed with every word of it.
Uh-huh. She, that's interesting that she might have felt comfortable with him. It sounds like she probably, like a lot of the British people who came to the country at that time, they probably didn't find too many Americans that they cared for.
That's really true, yeah. Well, you know, even Mark Twain said that the Mississippi Valley was a semi-barbarism setting itself up for a high civilization.
Yeah.
And so most of the people, most of the celebrated British travelers, Charles Dickens, for instance, really loathed the Mississippi. In part, Dickens loathed it because of slavery. And he's actually one of the few writers I came up with who was denouncing slavery as such. Certainly most Americans at the time had a very sort of equivocal attitude towards it.
The conditions that favored the moving of goods and people also favored the transmission of disease.
Yes.
Epidemics were
huge
regular
epidemics.
And all kinds of diseases, yellow fever. I guess I was struck just because now the issue of cholera in Haiti has been in the news.
Yeah.
There was, in the 1800s, there was a major cholera epidemic along
there. There were several, actually, yeah. Mm-hmm. I described the first one in the book. And I wasn't able to go to describe the later ones, but it came out of nowhere as far as Americans were concerned. In 1832, there had been no cases of cholera reported in the New World before then, and it became this major scourge over the 19th century. Hmm. And there were repeated waves of cholera epidemics.
And this would be the time when essentially, as far as infectious disease went, there was nothing. There was pretty much nothing that you could do.
There was nothing. You know, it's strange because they did sort of guess at certain things, like with yellow fever. I found several. It wasn't proved that the yellow fever was spread by mosquitoes until the early 20th century. But you can find writers in the 19th century kind of guessing there had to be a connection. So it wasn't as though they were totally ignorant. But without any kind of, you know, system of medicine, these discoveries tended to go to nowhere.
Yeah, these things that we now think of as being sort of tropical or semi-tropical diseases, yellow fever, malaria, were things that were very common there.
Yes,
at
they
that
were.
Time.
Yeah,
well, we're down to the point we have to finish up.
Okay.
Just generally, I think you said you set out to try to see if you could learn what life was really like and take people back to that time.
Yeah,
you feel that you've done that?
I don't know whether I've done it or not, but I will tell you that the best reaction that I've had so far was a friend of mine who said that she would read a page of the book and think, oh, my God, I wish I lived there. And then she would turn and read the next page and say, thank God I didn't live there. And that really was the reaction I was hoping.
I can definitely see that because there are so many, you would say there were so many things you wish maybe you would like to see, not necessarily that you would like to experience.
Yeah, firsthand,
things.
It would have been a very, very tough experience.
Oh, yeah, it would have been. And, you know, you can't really underestimate how probably even for people of means, this would not be an easy time or place to live.
No. And people were very callous about death and suffering in those days. I think that was the part of it that I found sort of most dismaying, is that the river coarsened the people who lived along it in a way that isn't very attractive to see now.
There are many great stories in this book. So, again, I just want to mention, if you'd like to read some on this time and this place, the book is Wicked River, The Mississippi When It Last Ran Wild. And it's published by Pantheon, by our guest Lee Sandlin. He makes his home in Chicago. He's been a regular contributor to the Chicago Reader. This is his first book. And, Mr. Sandlin, thank you very much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available, and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
AM how'd you like to help this radio station and spiff up your driveway at the same time?
What are we doing, going into the paving business once again?
No, it's Car Talk's new vehicle donation program where you donate a car. The proceeds benefit this station, and you tuck it to the IRS at the same time.
Hat trick!
And you can do it all on the web.
To learn more, call 866-789-8627.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn, 1 minute before noon Central Time. In Kansas City, March wheat trading at 861 and a quarter, up 3/4. May, 870, up 1. March wheat in Chicago, 806 and a quarter, up 8. May, 831 and a quarter, up 7 and a quarter. March corn, 626, up 2 3/4. May, 633 3/4, up 2.5. July, 638. Make that 637 3/4, up 3 1/4. September, 588 1/2, up 3 1/2. January beans, 1372 1/2, down 3 1/4. March, 1383 1/2, down 3 1/2. May, 1390, down 3 1/2. July, 1392, down 4. August, 1361 3/4, down 3 1/4. January meal, 367.70, down 90. January oil, 56.56. That's